Good afternoon. I'd like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, February 5th, 2024. The time is 1:32 p.m. And I'd just like to take a moment to say happy birthday to my son, Jack David. It's his birthday today. We are meeting in the Max Grunberg Committee Room 120 in the Capitol Building here in Juneau. I ask that you please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Talia from the Juneau LIO and Sophia with House Records. The following members present is Representative Johnson, Representative Gray, Representative Carpenter, Representative Groh, Representative Sumner, and myself, Chair Vance. We have a quorum to conduct business. On today's agenda, we have two items. One is to bring back House Bill 67, Harassment, Sex Offender, and Offenses, as submitted by the governor, and House Bill 97, Self-Storage Units, Liens, and Sales by Representative Prox. First on the agenda is House Bill 67, and we will ask the Criminal Division of the Department of Law to give us another overview. This is its third hearing, so I'd like to welcome to the table Director for the Criminal Division of Department of Law, Ms. Angie Kemp, and Assistant Attorney General, Ms. Casey Schroeder, if there are questions. If you could please state your name for the record and give us a refresher on House Bill 67.
Perfect. Thank you for the opportunity to reintroduce this piece of legislation. For the record, my name is Angie Kemp. I'm the division director for the criminal division within the Department of Law. Once again, thank you for this opportunity. I know that some of the folks on this committee have heard this piece of legislation before, but I'm going to quickly summarize some of the highlights. The purpose of this legislation is primarily twofold: to eliminate gaps in the Alaska criminal justice system, and to improve our ability to help victims and by avoiding the unnecessary need of re-traumatizing those individuals. This purpose of this legislation is truly about reducing trauma, and we believe that it achieves those goals for a number of reasons. I'm going to start with the discussion about sex offender registry and the importance to this piece of legislation has on that loophole. It closes a loophole in the sex offender registry statutes that, for example, allow a defendant convicted in another state to move to Alaska and use Alaska as a safe haven to avoid registration requirements. The way that this is achieved is that in 2019, as many folks probably remember, there was a change to the legislation that was prospective looking. The primary aim of this legislation is to require that folks who are convicted in other states of offenses that require them to register won't be able to use Alaska as a safe haven if they come to Alaska. In other words, we will respect the wishes of our sister states, and they will also be required to register here in Alaska. As may be well known, unfortunately, Alaska has more than four times roughly the rate of the national average of sexual assault rate, and almost double the next closest state. Under the law as it's currently drafted, incentivizes people who are convicted in other states from coming to Alaska and using it as a tool to avoid registration requirements. So once again, this fixes a loophole and prevents individuals who are required to register in other states from coming to Alaska and using it as an opportunity to avoid those registration requirements. The second important thing that this piece of legislation does is it closes a loophole in our stalking statutes. The loophole that this closes is that in stalking in the first degree, a person can commit the crime of stalking in the first degree if, while they're engaging in the stalking, they're also subject to a domestic violence protective order. There's no similar provision in place for when a person is subject to a stalking protective order. So in other words, a person who is subject to the domestic violence protective order and commits stalking could potentially be liable for stalking in the first degree, whereas a person who is subject to a stalking protective order and commits stalking isn't necessarily liable for the stalking in the first degree. So that closes that loophole. Another way that this piece of legislation promotes public safety and reduces loopholes is by requiring consecutive sentences for any offense that's violating conditions of release. So in other words, right now under current law, A person can commit as many violating conditions of release as they choose, and there's no requirement that additional penalties be imposed for that, for those repeated violations. This closes that loophole and requires that at least one day of additional penalty will be required for each violation that they're convicted of. This the last component of the piece of legislation is what I would say is maybe the primary aspect of this piece of legislation. And by that I mean the way that we're reducing trauma to the victims and using it as a means to not perpetuate unnecessarily trauma to those individuals. And when I talk about individuals, I'm talking both about witnesses and victims. And that's the direct rule change that is incorporated into section, I believe it's section 12. This provision, as the committee has previously heard, brings us in line with roughly 30 other jurisdictions, including the federal government. This is not something that's necessarily unique to Alaska, and it's something that that Alaska is in the minority when it as it relates to relying on hearsay at a grand jury presentation. This provision relaxes the rule, but it doesn't do away with it. We would still be in the minority and have a more, what I would say, intense rule, more restrictive rule than the vast majority of most states. This does not, I think it's important to understand that this does not prevent a grand jury from insisting upon additional evidence. So in other words, if the grand jurors came forward and said, we would like to hear this witness's testimony, this legislation does not reduce their ability to ask for that additional information. Likewise, it doesn't prevent the grand jury, the prosecutor, from having an independent obligation to produce exculpatory evidence or evidence that would tend to suggest the defendant is innocent of what he or she is accused of doing. Another important way that this piece of legislation does not affect current law and will not affect current law is it still preserves the right of the defendant to challenge the sufficiency of the evidence. So in other words, by filing a motion to dismiss the indictment and suggesting that there was some flaw or some evidence that wasn't presented that should have been presented, or there just wasn't enough evidence from their perspective to support that indictment. I think in order to appreciate this particular provision and this request, it's important to understand how a case proceeds through grand jury. As many of you may know, the way that the system works is that a person who is arrested and is in custody at the time, the state has 10 days to get that case to the grand jury. So if, for example, a case, someone's arrested for murder in the first degree on Sunday, and the grand jury day is Thursday, the prosecutor is obligated to present that case to the grand jury by Thursday of that week and present the evidence sufficient to establish probable cause. If what that practically means is that any of the victims or witnesses that were a part of that offense will necessarily need to assemble, come in, and testify in person or over the phone, depending upon where they live, but are required to come in and testify. If a person's out of custody, they have 20 days, but still on a very rigid timeline to get that case presented to the grand jury. That does not mean that we simply can ignore an individual who, for example, was sexually abused or sexually assaulted we're still required to bring that person into court and have them testify in front of the grand jury. For those of you who maybe don't know, the grand jury is typically made up of 18 individuals, and it requires the witnesses to testify in person and in front of those grand jurors about those things that have happened to them. I think maybe an easy way to illustrate this point is to give you an example of a case that I prosecuted years ago. This case happened in Juneau, and it involved a 14-year-old girl, and she was walking near Dryden Middle School, and she was had her headphones in. She was listening to music. At the time, she was forcibly abducted and strangled to the point that she was unconscious. She was thrown in the back of an individual's car, taken to a nearby residence, and repeatedly raped and sexually abused in ways that are hard, I think, for some folks to imagine. That little girl, that 14-year-old little girl, was required within, I believe it was 7 days, from the point of the offense until the time when that she was required to come in and testify before the grand jury. We could not prevent that. We had to have her come in and sit in that grand jury room and testify in front of 18 strangers, a prosecutor, a court clerk, and relive what probably was the most traumatic, certainly the most traumatic moment of her life. This piece of legislation is designed to eliminate or reduce unnecessary stress and re-victimization that folks go through daily. And that's just one example of countless. Another example that I'm aware of is a three-year-old victim who watched one of his parents murdered, was the only recipient witness to that case, and that individual, it's being litigated whether that individual needed to have come and testified in person before the grand jury about that. Again, Alaska is already insists upon or requires a level of presentation that most states do not require. Roughly 30 other states, including the federal government, do not require the prosecution to bring in witnesses in the way that we do. Alaska would be in the minority for jurisdictions as far as what level of proof is required to at a grand jury presentation. This piece of legislation and this particular provision allowing a witness, typically a law enforcement witness, to summarize admissible testimony, we believe will go a long way in both preserving the due process of the defendant and making sure that his or her rights are respected, but also drawing a maybe healthier balance between the victim and witness's rights and also the due process interests of the defendant. So again, this particular provision, the aim of it is to reduce re-victimization and the trauma that victims and witnesses go through when they have to come and relive these experiences and testify repeatedly, both at the grand jury and then, of course, if the case goes to trial again then. And this is all after they've been interviewed, sometimes repeatedly in connection with the case. Those are my introductory comments as it pertains to the legislation. I don't know if there's any follow-up questions for me. Happy to take them.
Thank you, Ms. Kemp. I am going to allow about 5 minutes worth of questions because we do have people waiting to testify. But, you know, obviously there's questions. And then if we do have time, the priority is the public. I do have one amendment, but that is getting clarification and public testimony is the priority today. So any questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, the section about allowing the summaries at grand jury testimony, would this law make us consistent with what the other 30 states are doing and the federal government?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Gray, the answer to that is there are different gradations. I don't want to overstate things, but there are many, many states, and I actually can, if you'd like, I can provide you with a list of those states that do not limit the hearsay presentation, and many states that allow pure summaries of the testimony. The federal government is one example of that. I can probably turn my page here in my book and probably give you other examples, but it depends on which state you're looking at, but roughly 30, and there are many, and I should say, one point of clarification too, there are many that both require an indictment, a presentation of an indictment like Alaska does for any felony, but then also do not restrict the presentation of hearsay. Alaska, of course, is, as you likely know, is one of those states that our Constitution requires presentation of a felony case to the grand jury, and many states that do not also then require or limit hearsay presentations.
Follow up.
Can you let us know exactly which states have it exactly the way this bill would have it.
Sure, absolutely. I can certainly provide that, and I'll do that here hopefully today or tomorrow.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to be, is it in statute that a witness has to appear in person, or is that a court rule?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, thank you for that. So it is not in statute that requires a person to appear in person. The court rules limit or require a person to appear in person because of the limitations that have been placed on the use of hearsay. So there are a few exceptions to that. For one exception is, for example, if there is a police investigator, that police investigator can summarize the work of the other investigators and the other police officers in the case. So that's one example of where hearsay by the rule is permitted. But the short answer to your question is, no, it's not in statute. It's in court rule.
Follow up?
I don't know if it's a question or a statement. It seems to me like the court rule is writing statute.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I'm not sure how to answer that. maybe it is a statement.
It may have just been a statement.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, there is no Alaska state statute that is directing the hearsay provision that we're discussing with respect to the courts. That it is 100% court rules that are guiding our policy on hearsay.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, yes, that the limits that are covered by rule are based upon court rule and sometimes court cases that work their way through the court and analysis and opinions by courts. But yes, again, short answer is court rule.
Follow up.
Is that hearsay, the prohibition against use of hearsay for an indictment, or prohibition against hearsay being brought before a grand jury?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think I understand your question. You're trying to distinguish as between a presentation, and maybe if you could rephrase, I can make sure I answer the question correctly.
Is the court limiting the information that can come between, sorry, is the court limiting the information that can come before the grand jury, or limiting what can be used in an indictment?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think the answer is both. The court rules, unless there are exceptions like the exception that I mentioned to Representative Johnson, or a compelling justification to introduce hearsay. Compelling justification might be voluminous records, or if someone's so critically injured and they're a victim of the case that they can't physically come to testify, those have been found by court case decisions to be compelling justifications to introduce some hearsay. But absent some provision in the rule that specifically authorizes it or infers it's authorized, then the rule prevents us from using hearsay.
I just want to be very clear that the grand jury has a constitutional obligation to investigate crime, and the court rules are preventing certain information from coming before the grand jury. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kemp. Seeing no further questions at this time. Representative Groh.
Well, thank you, Mentor. I guess I want to clarify somewhat, if I could. The federal and state constitutions have various constitutional guarantees for individual rights, some of which involve rights for convocation of witnesses. Would you agree that the Alaska court system would probably say that it's trying, as you alluded or suggested, trying to follow various court decisions and constitutional doctrines and in fashioning the court rules?
Through the chair, Representative Groh, thank you. That's a good question. So Succinctly, yes, that their charge is to ensure that in evaluation of the constitutional conventions and the history surrounding that and the aim of those folks in creating several provisions in our Constitution to ensure that going forward that those that their wishes are respected and try and glean what they intended by some of the language that they used. The courts are then charged with evaluating their intent in large part and assessing it as against the constitutional requirements. So answer your question is yes, that it's grounded on in those concepts.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Kim. I would now like to open up for public testimony on House Bill 67. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? We have Aaron Walker Tolls from Catholic Community Services. If you could please state your name for the record, you will have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Aaron Walker Tolles. I'm Executive Director of Catholic Community Service. We're a regional faith-based nonprofit serving all of Southeast Alaska. We operate a child advocacy center, and child advocacy centers are a critical part of the justice process for children who have experienced abuse, particularly sexual abuse. Those children are required by law, by statute, to be referred to a child advocacy center. The centers are designed and are accredited to follow certain standards that are focused on not re-traumatizing the child. That means that our forensic interviewers are trained to have a neutral stance and engage with the child in a safe, developmentally appropriate way and ask non-leading questions in order to determine whether or not there is some amount of evidence that abuse has happened or that a crime happened that they may have witnessed. We are absolutely in support of HB 67 for, in general, that's focused on not re-traumatizing children and victims of sexual assault, but in particular of the provision to not ask a child to come and have to testify at grand jury. All of the data, all of the research shows that having to tell that story over and over again does re-traumatize the child. It locks it in. They feel re-victimized, creates very big problems for a child who's supposed to be, at this point, trying to now be safe and to move forward with services that we refer them to, family advocacy, counseling. Sometimes they have to change where they live. They sometimes have lost a family member in the process of disclosing this. So we'd like to just voice our support and encourage you to support HB 67 through the process.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, we have Katie Capozzi. If you could please state your name and affiliation. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Katie Capozzi, and I'm testifying today as a private citizen, not in my capacity at the Alaska Chamber that some of you may know me in. So to be clear, the Alaska Chamber does not have a position HB 67, but I do. So I'm Katie Capozzi, a resident of Eagle River, and I testify today in support of HB 67. Specifically, I support the provision that eliminates the unnecessary and sometimes traumatic burden placed on victims of crimes by requiring them to appear in person before a grand jury to answer questions about the crime they were victimized by. The current requirement seems inconvenient at best, for example, in the case of a stolen car or something like that, to highly traumatic at worst, for example, in the case of rape. For either of those examples and all of the crimes that can happen in between, the current requirement seems to further victimize the victim. The change proposed in this bill would allow key witnesses, often the officer assigned to the case, to summarize the testimony of the victim. This practice, as you just heard, is used across the country and would be one very simple step that you all can take to protect victims of crime rather than punish them or cause them more trauma. Secondly, the provision requiring sex offenders to register in Alaska if they're required to register in the state that they are convicted in just makes sense. And I didn't actually realize that this wasn't already taking place until I read the bill. So if you're a bad guy or a bad gal in a state in Alabama, that means you're a bad guy or you're a bad gal in Alaska or anywhere else in the world. So this correction needs to be made, hopefully immediately, to protect all members of the public. Thank you for considering my comments today. I urge you to pass this bill out of committee, and I appreciate your service to Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? We have Ms. Barbara Stanfield. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. Brenda Stanfield with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. We support everything in this bill. It's a good bill according to our member programs and closes some very important loopholes. And I really want to spend my time talking about the court rules. One of the things that I have observed over my years of spending 25 years working directly with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault was the impact of the grand jury. Oftentimes, we've created these great, what we call sexual assault response teams. They come together. The person only has to tell their story once because everybody is together in this team. And we've tried to be trauma-informed, make sure we're connecting them with services. But the minute they step into this grand jury process, it's kind of like this hurdle that they have to get over in order for this case to go forward. We responded 4 times in 1 year to a woman who was sexually assaulted. She couldn't stay sober for the 7 days that she needed to be there for grand jury. And by the time grand jury was to be convened, they couldn't find this person. So this homeless person was sexually assaulted 4 different times. The last 2 times she didn't report because what was the point? She knew she couldn't get through the grand jury process. Yet here was all this evidence that they could have used if they could have gotten past that. Again, years ago, we had what we now refer to as sex trafficking. At that time, we didn't have those words. Someone would come forward and be willing to testify. But again, the time it took to get from the point of having had the witness come talk to police and all of these things and then getting to grand jury. His name was Bruno. He was allowed to go for years before they got him on falsification for an ATM. Never did get him on the sex trafficking. So grand jury has really been a hurdle in our state for many, many, many years. And this change in the court rules could really allow cases that really are about very bad people, and then me being a car, had my car stolen. I wasn't a car thief. I had to go in and actually say that was my car, take time off. I never did get any restitution. So, you know, it is the full gamut. So I appreciate you taking the time to hear this today and would encourage you to pass this forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, I want to move to online. We have Keely Olson. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. Thank you to the chair and to the committee. This is Keely Olson. I am the executive director of STAR, and I'm speaking for STAR, or Standing Together Against Rape Today, in support of HB 67. We feel that there is, you know, great impact in passing this legislation to repeal or relax the requirement that victims be forced to come in and testify at grand jury, merely to find probable cause that a crime has occurred. I have been an advocate, a crime victim advocate, for 30 years. I've worked in multiple states, and this is the first one that I've worked in for the last 16 years that has a grand jury and requires victims to testify. I think it is unnecessary, as Ms. Stanfield was just saying. We have many, many vulnerable people throughout our community who are victimized, and they are transient by nature. They're difficult to find. Oftentimes, any way that we would have to reach them would be via phone. Maybe their phone was damaged or destroyed during an assault. Oftentimes, our advocates go out with law enforcement on the day before grand jury looking for these people to be able to make that 10-day time frame if the offender is in custody. And, you know, if we're not able to find them, that offender is cut loose and goes free to reoffend again. They can try and reserve time. They can try and reschedule the grand jury. But it's important to note that this is a hurdle that offenders can take advantage of by having extremely vulnerable and transient victims. I've been to court with victims as young as 10 years old. Certainly, that is re-traumatizing. And every other part of our response to victims of crime is to be trauma-informed. And this is not a trauma-informed practice at all.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Olson. Unfortunately, your 2 minutes is up. Next, we have Stacey Yates, Director of Human Trafficking and Recovery Services at My House. You have 2 minutes to testify. Please state your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chairman, thank you. I am Stacey Yates, Director of Human Trafficking Recovery Services here at My House in Wasilla, and the chair of the statewide coalition, ASHTA, Alaska Stop Human Trafficking Alliance, and I also sit on the Governor's Council of Human and Sex Trafficking. As a survivor of sex trafficking, and on behalf of all victims of crime, I come to you asking you to please move forward on HB 67. According to the 2019 FBI crime report, it states that Alaska's sexual assaults are 4 times the national average, and our child sexual assaults are 6 times the national average. Six. If you haven't had the opportunity, please go see the new data summary report that the Council of Human and Sex Trafficking released last week at dps.alaska.gov/CHST. And you can see for yourself the numbers that organizations across our state are reporting for trafficking. My House in Wasilla for 2023 reported 47 clients being sex trafficked and 1 reported being labor trafficked. We have a horrific hidden crime going on in our state. Our most vulnerable are being forced into the sex trade industries right here in Alaska. Alaska's criminal justice system is in desperate need of reform. It re-victimizes and re-traumatizes those who have already suffered enough. No other state in the nation forces victims to relive their nightmares over and over again. And you wonder why more victims are not coming forward to get justice? It is cruel and inhumane to make victims repeat their stories and expose their wounds, especially when they have already given that evidence to medical and law enforcement professionals, often with audio and video proof. Victims deserve respect and dignity, not more pain and humiliation. Please pass this critical victims' rights bill as soon as possible. Let's do better and protect the victims and reduce traumas for all victims of crime in our great state of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Betty Jo Moore from Anchorage. Please state your name for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, please continue.
Okay. My name is Betty Jo Moore. I live in Anchorage. Victim trauma. Alaska Statute 4705060, purpose and policy relating to children. Department of Children's Services have addressed policies on adverse childhood experiences and childhood brain development, 30th Legislature, SB 105. HB 67 needs several edits, pages 2, 3, 4, 5, page 10, and pages 11 and through 13 need to address Alaska Court Rules 303, 403, 404, 801, and 803. SB 01993 regarding a grand jury secured during a phone consultation followed by a letter dated August 16, 2022 by General Taylor and Chief Justice Winfrey was signed 12-1-2022. New information about grand jury investigations, a 3-page document regarding SCO 1993 still needs addressing. This document is new information, but where are the procedural rules governing SCO 1993 process? Alaska Statute 1240.030, the grand jury shall inquire into all crimes committed or triable within the jurisdiction of the court, and the grand jury shall have the power to investigate. Okay, I want to address hearsay is based on information that witnesses got from someone else. Hearsay in any criminal or civil case is dangerous to a person and his or her family. Hearsay without facts and witnesses can destroy children and family. Hearsay is a lie when the repeater takes facts out of context and tells his or her own version, his or her own reality of that truth, that hearsay. I support HB 67 with the necessary edits that we are talking about here today. And I just want to also thank this Bill for coming forward. And the most important thing is our children in Alaska are paramount.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we go to Adrian Bergenzini of Soldotna. If you could please state your name for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Adrian Bergenzini.
Please continue.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Adrian Bergenzini. I am from Soldotna, Alaska, District 8. I would like to give my public testimony. I am speaking for myself as a concerned mother who has had to endure losing a child to a human trafficker. I would like to my testimony to be recorded that I am for the passing and support of HB 67, SB 65, the Victim Trauma Reduction Act. I would also like to see HB 68, SB 66, the Anti-Human and Sex Trafficking Act, passed to further support and protect our Alaskan people, victims, and survivors. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Thomas Garber of Anchorage. If you could please state your name for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Ben Carpenter's concerns with the criminal rules on Supreme Court Order 1993 is preventing some information from coming before the grand jury, specifically criminal rule 6.1. Supreme Court Order 1993 is impinging some information from coming before a grand jury outside of the prosecutor's realm. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Corella Bagan from Sitka. If you could please state your name for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, committee. I'm calling today representing myself and my family. I am Corey Bagan. I'm a fourth generation Alaska, and I live in Sitka. I'm calling in today to voice my strong support for House Bill 67. This bill is very important to me for personal reasons. On May 4th, 1996, my sister Jessica was brutally tortured, raped, and murdered here in Sitka. Steve Branch, the man who murdered my sister, wasn't a transient. He lived right here in Sitka for years. He had committed a rape here in Sitka prior to killing my sister, but was not convicted. However, we don't know if he committed similar crimes before he moved to Alaska. He was not a registered sex offender to our knowledge. My family had to wait 24 years for her murderer to be identified, and that's why I want House Bill 67 to be passed. Help protect Alaska's innocent and victimized. You've already heard tons of testimony of all the things that are in the bill, so instead of rehashing it, I just think that it's super important that we close that loophole in our current laws that make Alaska a place that sex offenders can avoid registration. We need to fix our laws so that we're not an attractive place for sex offenders and child kidnappers to live in our communities without us knowing. We also need to better protect our victims of domestic violence and stalking. I think that this bill will better protect Alaska's innocent children. House Bill 67 will do more to support and positively impact Alaska victims than any other action this legislature can take. So please, let's get this bill passed. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Ed Martin of Kenai. You have 2 minutes. Please begin your testimony and state your name for the record, please.
Yes, this is Ed Martin, Jr. I reside in Kenai, Alaska. Thank you, Chairwoman, and our other representative on this Judiciary Committee. I support this bill, but it needs work still. The portion that talks about registration of sex offenders, I firmly support, and stalking. But when you get into the sections that talk about admissible evidence, I don't believe that a prosecuting attorney should just have belief. There should be evidence, and evidence should be brought to a grand jury. Now, we have cases that have come in recent days in the Kenai Court, which I sat through, where a probable cause hearing that involved a couple children from our school on the Kenai, by the way, on a suspicion of abuse that ended up being a 10-week ordeal for the parent to argue her case that there was no probable cause. And in fact, after 10 weeks, the judge ruled in favor of the woman. And to get her children back. So there is some problems, and this multi-agency team, as far as I'm concerned, need to be qualified. You guys have a section in there that actually Ben repeals Alaska Statute 12.40.110, which deals with what is in statute already. They're trying to repeal it in this bill. It needs to be looked at in more detail. I can tell you this, that one woman that lost her children because some school teacher had some suspicion, didn't follow the IEP for the school to take her to the nurse. And then it got in the hands of OCS, and their so-called social worker had an associate's degree in administrative management.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Martin. Next, we have Jessica Vadrul from Shishmaref. If you could please state your name for the record, you have 2 minutes.
Yeah, hi. The name is Vaudre. And I'm calling from Shishmaref. Thank you for taking my call today. I see a man here, and he's a born-again Christian. He did a bad thing, served his time more than 15 years ago, and has been dutifully registering himself every year. And then because of some ambiguities in secondary addresses and a moose permit, he could be in big trouble now. And he's going through a lot of problems, you know, with court and continuations with his trial, which is another mess. It's a big, hot mess, the correction system. You know, he's been told that he's been offered a plea bargain, which he never even heard about. He's had turnover after turnover of attorneys and public defenders who are losing his paperwork. You know, and this is a man who he has been reformed through the redemptive qualities in Jesus Christ. You know, and he's had to live with the stigmata. The state is not letting him move on. He served his time. And he's not a kidnapper. He's not a threat anymore. He's not a sex offender anymore. And that's what really gets me about this, because that's who, you know, he did a bad thing a long time ago that might have, you know, given him that title, but that's not who he is today. And he can't move on. We can't move on as a family. And the other thing is that, you know, when I see a man dressed as a woman down the street in a school with fake eyelashes, lipstick, and he wants himself to be called a she and a woman's name, and I think of the trauma inflicted on that second grader who's looking at this man with a deep voice dressed like a woman, and that's okay. That's not a sex offender, right? But a man who has been redeemed through our Lord Jesus Christ is going through this trial and tribulation still, while in schools, in my opinion, we have worse problems, you know, with this gender identity thing going on. And it's just really sad. And I'm losing faith in our corrections institutions, our schools, you know, and, you know, I just want to say that there needs to be reform with this law, and not everybody is, you know, a threat. You know, I'd rather leave my son alone with my friend here than put him in a school with a man who thinks he's a woman. So, and that's all I have to say. And I'm going to send in written testimony with some details about the corrections institution and everything else. So thank you for taking my call, and thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Suki Miller from Anchorage. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
Hi, this is Suki Miller. I'm the executive director at Victims for Justice. I'm calling in support of HB 67, in specific the court rule to repeal that requires victims to testify in person. Brenda mentioned this earlier, just even with small crimes like your car getting stolen, having to go in, and, you know, just the ongoing backlog we have that's lingering from COVID. The current court system rule, it's cruel to victims, it's costly, it's inefficient, and adds to the court's backlog. And this act greatly reduces the stress and trauma Alaska crime victims are forced to experience, all while making Alaska's criminal justice system more compassionate, fair, rational, and efficient. So I strongly encourage the passage or the support of HB 67. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for for everyone who testified today. Your participation in the public process is greatly appreciated and valued in every way. So seeing no other testifiers online, let me double check. I will now close public testimony in House Bill 67. For those watching online who did not have an opportunity to testify, you can email your written testimony to house.judiciary@akleg.gov, and it will be uploaded to the record in that manner. So House Bill 67 is now before us, and I do have one amendment that I would like for the committee to consider, and I am going to invite my policy advisor, Mr. Bob Ballinger, to the table. But before I do that, if I could have
Madam Chair, I move amendment number one, which is actually 33-GH1031/8/11
and
for consideration.
I object for purposes of discussion. Mr. Ballinger, if you could please come to the table and present the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob Ballinger from Representative Vance's office. This amendment is really pretty straightforward. It does some important things, but it's not substantial. Doesn't really change much of the policy of the legislation. The first part on page one of the amendment, probably the most substantial part, but what it does is it changes sex trafficking, or includes sex trafficking in the list of crimes that are provided on the Red Shield. So these are individuals who are witnesses. And essentially what it says is you can't go back and use the witness's history of sexual involvement or whatever in the prosecution of sex trafficking. Then on page two at the top, those are probably the other two substantive changes, or maybe the most substantive. And essentially it changes the age from 20 to 21 for the age of basically consent, or the age to make these crimes fall into the sex crime designation. So, you know, if you were involved in prostitution with somebody who was 20 before this would make, or was 19 before this would make it work. If you're 20, that'd still fall into the sex crimes. And that is basically two different code sections that provide the same thing. And then if you look on page three at the very bottom, everything else in here, as far as the changes, it just changes section numbers. And then at the very bottom, on page three, changed the date of it being enacted from 2023, because, of course, this was filed last year, to 2024. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions on amendment number one from committee members? Representative Gray.
Sure. Through the chair, can you explain again about the change from 20 to 21?
Yeah, and thank you, Representative Gray, through the chair. I'm sorry, I didn't really do that justice the first time. So within that code section, for it to be a sex crime, if you're involved in a list of crimes, let me go ahead and go to the bill, and so I can provide that data or that list. So once again, it's on page 8 and 9. First one's at line 12. So if you look on page 12, before these are a list of things that would be considered a sex crime. And then it says, or if the person was induced or caused to engage in prostitution, it was under 20 years old. So that essentially would be a 19-year-old or under. Now essentially be a 20-year-old or under. And if it falls into this category, then these are defined as sex offenses.
Any further questions from committee members? I will remove my objection. Are there any further objections on amendment number one? Hearing none, amendment number one passes.
Thank you, committee.
Thank you for that. We will now set House Bill 67 aside, and we will continue the amendment process and discussion on Wednesday. And the amendment deadline is tomorrow, Tuesday the 6th, by 5 p.m. to our office. This is a great bill that that I want to be able to give the due diligence on. On our second agenda item today, we will bring House Bill 97, self-storage units and liens. But before we invite Representative Prox, I just want to thank Ms. Kemp and everyone who is available to testify on this bill. We will be taking it up further and doing more work on that. I just wanted to give a little bit more time for the committee to kind of let things digest before we take it up further action on it on Wednesday. So thank you for that. At this time, I'd like to invite to the table Representative Prox and his staff. If you could please place your names on the record, you may begin walking the committee through this bill.
We have a brief at ease.
For the record, have a brief at ease. Back on record, please state your name for the record and begin presenting House Bill 97.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, there we go. And I'm Mike Prox, representative for District 33, the North Pole Badger Road area in the interior. And with me is?
For the record, my name is Maggie Elliott, staff to Representative Prox.
All right. So with that, HB 97 adds a new section to Alaska's lien laws for foreclosure liens that specifically address self-storage units. And 49 states and the District of Columbia have self-storage lien statutes. Alaska is the last remaining state without a self-storage lien statute. These laws provide for a non-judicial foreclosure process to address and remedy non-payment issues between the facility owner and the unit renter. Storage liens are the national standard for settling disputes between facility owners and unit renters. Self-storage lien laws provide protections for unit renters. HB 97 would require facility owners to include specific information regarding the facility owner's lien rights in the rental agreement. HB 97 would also require the facility owner to wait at least 10 days after the unit renter's default to begin lien enforcement. After 10 days, the facility owner would be required to send a default notice to the unit renter. If the unit renter does not cure the default, the facility owner would then be required to send a second notice of default to the unit renter that provides an additional 20-day window for the unit renter to cure the default. If the payment issue is not remedied, then HB 97 would permit the facility owner to proceed with the sale. The bill details the process and how proceeds from that sale must be applied. HB 97 also provides certainty and protection for storage facility owners. The bill would provide a specific statutory process for facility owners to follow to enforce their lien rights in the state. And probably would be best to hear from Mr. Bryant, if he is with us.
Mr. Bryant, we have Daniel Bryant from Legal and Legislative Counsel from the Self-Storage Association. Mr. Bryant, would you please state your name and affiliation for the record and provide your invited testimony? You have 10 minutes.
Thank you very much, Daniel Bryant, for the record, Legal and Legislative Counsel for the National Self-Storage Association. And again, Chair Vance and members of the House Judiciary Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Again, for the record, my name is Daniel Bryant, and I'm with the National Self-Storage Association based in Alexandria, Virginia. As for your support today for House Bill 97, this bill would require owners to follow a uniform procedure after a default, So the process would be the same whether you were renting a storage unit in Fairbanks or Juneau or Anchorage. This is a significant consumer protection. Additionally, it provides certainty to storage facility owners that they know the correct process to follow to safeguard their business. I wanted to start with a little bit of background on the industry and then walk through the bill. So in self-storage, the operator and tenant have a commercial landlord-tenant relationship. Broad swath of consumers use self-storage for a variety of reasons. Once a unit size is selected, a consumer signs a rental agreement, which is the contract that governs the relationship between the parties. Rental agreements are month-to-month agreements that renew only upon the mutual desire of both parties. So this is not a situation where consumers get stuck in a very lengthy lease. To the extent that they no longer need the unit, they're free to terminate on 30 days' notice. And for the vast majority of tenancies, they're successful for both parties. Goods are stored and rent is timely paid. As we've already heard, 49 states and the District of Columbia have a self-storage lien law, Alaska being the last state without such a law. Self-storage lien laws provide a non-judicial foreclosure process for addressing situations where the tenants fail to pay the rent and the storage owner must sell the property to satisfy the lien. Statutory lien laws are important because they provide a basic legal framework and guardrails to protect both owners and occupants. Again, this bill would ensure that several steps are taken before a sale, starting with the execution of a written rental agreement that informs the occupant of the lien and the fact that the property may be sold or disposed of upon default. Also, the occupant would be notified multiple times before the sale or disposal. Just one note before we get into some of the substance of the bill, but just wanted to highlight that none of what's contained in here today would impact or affect active duty service members. There's a federal statute, the Service Member Civil Relief Act, that covers service members in all 50 states, including Alaska. The SCRA has a specific provision that applies to self-storage that can be found at 50 U.S.C. Section 3958. So in practice, every storage owner, especially in areas with a heavy military population, is going to have a provision in their rental agreement that asks for prospective tenants about their military status. And even absent a disclosure, owners will still do a search through the Department of Defense Manpower Data Center prior to any sale just to confirm that that occupant is not an active duty service member. So turning to just some of the substance of the legislation itself, I just kind of wanted to touch on some of the rental agreement requirements and the notices, and then just kind of generally how the sale works and how any excess proceeds are handled to the extent that there are any. So again, as I mentioned, the bill would require that the rental agreement be a written document agreed upon and executed by both parties. The lien attaches on the date on which the property is placed in the unit. The storage owners are legally obligated to ensure that the rental agreement contained a statement in bold type notifying the unit renter of the existence of the lien. Again, the occupant must be notified of the lien upon execution of the rental agreement for that lien to be enforceable. And that's on page 2, lines 15 to 18. After being informed of the owner's lien rights in the rental agreement, to the extent a default occurs, the owner must send at least two notices to the occupant regarding that default, in providing an opportunity to cure. So the first notice may be sent by email or first-class mail to the occupant after they're in default for at least 10 days. Subsequent thereto, the second notice is sent by email, certified mail, or U.S. mail with a certificate of mailing at least 10 days after the first notice is sent and provides a minimum of 20 days to cure that default. So, subsequent to execution of the rental agreement and default notices being sent out, the occupant's been notified several times, but unfortunately, by and large, in certain instances, is just generally unresponsive. The bill affords the owner with three remedies. The first is to tow certain titled property. The second is to proceed with a sale. And finally, disposal of property that receives no bid or offer. So starting first with towing, many storage operators do not want to go through the process for selling title property. It can be rather cumbersome, and many operators are not frequently called upon to do so. So So this proposed legislation provide operators with the option to have certain property towed after default, and then the towing company would have to comply with the process for selling that titled vehicle. And this is a very common provision. 46 other states allow owners to tow vehicles under similar circumstances. Alternatively, if the default occurs, the personal property will be sold. Lien sales nationally are not money makers for storage owners. Owners are lucky to get 25 or 30 cents on the dollar owed, and many do not even realize that much. The primary objective for those sales is really just to return the unit back to inventory so that it can be rented out again to a paying customer. And just logistically, how those sales are required to be held under the statute or under the bill, excuse me. So an owner has to hold it either at the facility or on a publicly accessible internet website. And importantly, and just want to note that all occupants are able to exercise their redemption rights until that sale is final. And finally, we talked about towing and spoken about the sale. The third remedy provided in this bill is one that allows owners to dispose of property that they put up for sale, but, ultimately, nobody puts a bid or offer in, so they are able to conclusively determine that the value of the property is basically nothing, and they're able to proceed with and dispose of that property in whatever manner they deem appropriate. And then finally, after the sale, the bill outlines the order of payment from the proceeds obtained from that sale. To the extent that there's any excess remaining after the facility owner has been paid, any lien holders have been paid to the extent that there are any. If there are any excess, which for the record is a very rare occurrence, but the facility owner must hold that balance for 3 years. And to the extent that it is unclaimed after that period, then it has to be remitted to the state as excess proceeds. So just in conclusion, statutory lien laws provide an essential framework and guardrails to protect storage owners, consumers, so that both parties are aware of the appropriate process and procedure to follow in the event of default. HB 97 strikes an appropriate balance between facility owners and unit renters. And I ask the committee support to bring a self-storage lien statute to Alaska, the last remaining U.S. state without such a law. Thank you again for the opportunity to participate today, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. We will now open up questions from committee members. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know to whom this is addressed, but in the final communications before disposal, says email, certified letter, first class. Is email a certified letter is 100%. You get a signature, you get it back. Email could go off into the ether and never be seen. Do all states allow internet or email notifications, or is that unique to whomever?
This is Representative Crox. The best person to answer that would be Mr. Bryant. Can you enlighten us?
I'd be happy to. Through the chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So, yes, email communication is an extraordinarily common means of effectuating the notice. More than 40 states expressly permit that form of notification in their statute.
Follow-up. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, so 49 states in the District of Columbia have this. Why is Alaska so far behind?
Through the chair to Representative Gray. This is Representative Rox. I don't know.
Representative Gray, I've heard this bill before, and it simply didn't make it through the process. Any other questions by committee members? Well, I have some questions. And that same section 34 dealing with the default notice, talking about the 10 days notice after default, I am, and then 20 days after the date the notice is sent, with regard to the unreliable timeliness of mail in the state of Alaska, have you heard if this is a sufficient time for people to be able to respond and be notified that they are potentially going to be losing their property?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is Representative Prox. It seems reasonable to me. It's a total of 30 days. And I think it's fair to say that in most cases, well, I don't know if in most, but in many cases, the person effectively just disappears. That they have, the renter was supposed to give contact information to the facility owner, and then for whatever reason, they're no longer able to contact them. But as long as the unit owner is giving notice to the last known address, that is about all that can be expected. It's somewhat akin to the problem that we're facing with voter registration.
Mr. Bryant, what type of notification is provided to a renter when they are making this agreement? Is it a signed agreement that is all of the terms are written and that is verbally communicated and they sign it in full understanding? Or is it a pamphlet that is handed to them of, you know, here's what you're signing to? How open is the communication about the expectations?
Thank you, Chair Vance, for the question. So to answer it, yes, it has to be a written agreement. So rental agreement is defined in 34, 35, 670 specifically to say that it means a written agreement. And again, as mentioned prior in testimony, that it's, you know, the unit owner is obligated to apprise the occupant of the existence of the lien and, you know, ultimately what will transpire in the event that a monetary default occurs that's not cured within the time allotted in various notices.
Thank you for that. I have another question regarding the sale and disposal of property in Section 34. You know, can you talk about the type of notification that's given to that about the sale? Because sometimes people who are not paying attention to the notice that is sent to them may suddenly realize that their property is being sold. Please describe what that notification of sale looks like in this bill.
Thank you, Chair Vance, again for the question. So in this bill presently, there is nothing specific that needs to be done subsequent to the two default notices. I will say, just as a matter of practice, just nationally, every facility owner goes well above and beyond whatever the statutory minimum is. The objective really is always to remedy the payment dispute in a way that does not require sale of the property. So again, even if, as it's here, there's a minimum of two required notices, every owner is going to go above and beyond with, you know, emails, text messages, and other types of notification to make sure that they're, you know, effectuating the notices as best they can with the, you know, overarching objective to ensure that the sale does not occur. But specifically to your point, there is nothing in this bill specifically that is required subsequent to those two notices being sent.
Madam Chair?
Representative
Prox. This is Representative Prox. I think there is some notice on page 3, the second. It describes what's starting at line 15, it describes what the second notice of default must include. And that the, I don't know, do you want me to go through those verbally or just read through?
I think just for the public, okay. Just providing kind of an overview of what they're what their rights would be.
Okay. So the second notice of default must include, one, a statement that the unit property of the unit renter is subject to a storage lien and that the unit renter has been or will be denied access to the property until the facility owner's claim is satisfied. Two, the address of the self-storage facility, the name of the unit renter, and the number of the storage unit rented by the unit renter. Three, a statement of the charges due, the date of default, and a demand for payment of the charges due by a specified date, viz. At least 20 days after the date the notice was sent. Four, a statement in bold type, providing that unless the claim is paid by the date specified in the demand for payment, the unit property of the unit renter will be sold on or after a date specified in the notice. And finally, five, the name, address, and telephone number of the facility owner or a designated agent the unit renter may contact to respond to the notice. So there is specific things that would be included in the second notice.
Thank you. Do we have any further questions from committee members? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This may be showing my ignorance. I very rarely use a storage unit. Is there any recourse other than selling the property inside the rental unit? For example, if someone's storing batteries in there and there's a disposal charge, can that be, how's something like that handled? I mean, they're worthless, except it's going to cost you to get rid of them. So can you kind of walk me through the process of, does environmental conservation get involved, the police get involved? What happens if there's a meth lab, I don't know, for lack of a better, just illegal or costly to dispose of merchandise? Right.
Thank you. Through the chair to Representative Johnson, this specific bill doesn't address those concerns. It's just disposing of the property. As a practical matter, if that happens, that liability probably would still be left with the facility owner. If you will, the facility owner is out of luck. But this doesn't address that situation.
Follow up? So there's no interest or anything, just the sale of the property that's in the storage unit. There's no other recourse than just the value of the goods in, no interest rate, no nothing else.
Right. Through the chair. Correct. I hadn't really thought about this until just now, but this wouldn't address that. And then it would be a different matter that if the renter didn't declare that stuff to the facility owner at the time it was put in the rental unit, there would still be recourse under other law, perhaps, but this does not address that situation.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair. In my experience, people who have a storage room usually have it on a recurring charge on their credit card. So to me, I think probably the most likely scenario is that years go by and that credit card doesn't work anymore. And that might be a way that somebody's missing payments.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's kind of harkens back to my last question, but I'm curious if we know how big of an issue this is in Alaska. My guess is that it would be a really big issue in Alaska, that lots of people would have storage facilities here, potentially go to the lower 48, be out of contact.
Right. Thank you for the question. This is Representative Brock through the chair. I don't remember the specific average, if you will. Perhaps Mr. Bryant would know. Mr. Bryant?
Through the chair, Representative, thank you for the question. I do not have specific data on Alaska, but I will say the data that we do have, and this is more on a just national basis, again, not specific to Alaska, but approximately about 1 to 3% of units will go through this sale and auction process, or, you know, stated differently, you know, 97 to 99% of unit renters nationally will, again, use their unit per the terms and conditions of the rental agreement, and never have their belongings subject to one of these sales.
Yeah, thank you. And this is Representative Prox again. I didn't go through the process, but when my father died, we stored a bunch of his stuff in a rental unit, and had a bunch of other things on our mind, and we got late. And then when we got the notice, we went and resolved it right away. But quite often, people will just simply walk away from it. And then that usually leaves the facility owner with a bunch of more or less junk, packing material, wrapping paper, and et cetera. And then they incur the expense of cleaning all that up. And so their primary goal is to be able to clean that up sooner than later. Going through the normal court process, it might take a matter of 3 or 4 months just to go through the court hearing process to get permission to clean a bunch of packing material out of your unit.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. If this bill were adopted, property owner, self-storage property owner, who is going to go through a lien process, opens the door to the storage unit, and there's a ATV or something that's got a lien on it.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is reading this bill means that the property owner has the primary lien at that point, and the bank that has a note on that piece of equipment is secondary. So am I to understand that if the property owner sells the piece of property in order to satisfy the lien on the rental unit or the rental facility, that the owner of that property that had the secondary lien and the relationship they have with the bank who has the note is not affected in that regard? There just is no longer a piece of property for the bank to claim?
Thank you. Through the chair, this is Representative Prox. That is my understanding of the current version of the bill. And I think we have an amendment to remedy that so that the you might want to consider the lien, the bank's lien, if you will, supersedes the facility owner's lien. Currently, as written, though, the facility owner, their lien would supersede the bank's lien. And they have the bank representatives and the lien holders' representatives have gotten together, and my understanding, they have resolved that. The facility owners are more easygoing than I was going to be. But I think there's an amendment. Is that correct, Madam Chair?
I assume so.
Ah, okay.
Representative Prox.
We will figure this out in a minute. All right. Very good. Thank you.
Follow-up, Representative Carpenter?
I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Any further questions from committee members? Sounds like y'all did an excellent job with the presentation.
Two things. I think we need to adopt a committee substitute. Yes.
Well, let me take a brief at ease.
Okay.
Beck on the record, Representative Prox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was not correct. You do have the committee substitute from the Labor and Commerce Committee. And if I could ask my assistant to explain the changes between the original version and what we have before us.
For the record, my name is Maggie Elliott, staff to Representative Prox. I will refer to the sectional analysis. House Bill 97 adds Section 3435605, Priority of Storage Lien, on page 2, lines 8 through 12. This section notes that if a vehicle is an item of the unit property, a storage lien is superior to a lien or encumbrance established under AS 2810371 to AS 2810401, which means filing documents showing evidence of liens or encumbrance. Thank you.
Okay. And that, this is for the record, Representative Prox, and that I believe there's going to be an amendment to that specific section that is on its way to you.
Thank you so much, Representative Prox, for the presentation. And we will now set House Bill 97 aside. I am established. Representative Carpenter.
For the record, the public may be confused if we've got multiple versions of this bill. We said that we were taking up House Bill 97, which House Bill 97 is not the version that sits before us. CS for House Bill 97, Labor and Commerce, is actually the bill that we have before us. If you're looking on basis, you're going to see two different versions. The bill that's before us and what was referred to this committee, I believe, is CS for House Bill 97, Labor and Commerce. And that is what's before us, not House Bill 97, which right. is the previous version.
If we could take a brief at ease for a moment. Back on the record, I will now set House committee substitute for House Bill 97 aside. I am going to set an amendment deadline for Tuesday at 5 p.m. And we will work with if legal services can get back the amendment deadlines in time for us to distribute those to committee members. We will entertain taking those up on Wednesday if possible. So we will try to. We will then take up the amendment as provided by the sponsor that he previously mentioned. So that concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Wednesday, February 7th at 1 p.m. to bring back House Bill 97, self-storage units, liens, sales, the CS for House Bill 97. I will bring up HB 67, harassment, sex offenders, and also HB 161, Civil Legal Services, by Representative Reitnitz's first hearing. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 2:57 p.m.